Well, welcome everyone, and hello and greetings to wherever you are across the world. My name is Lynn Anderson, and I'll be moderating today's CIDR session. The CIDR sessions are sponsored by Athabasca University and its Center for Distance Education, as well as Illuminate Live. They're presented free of charge on the first Wednesday of the month at 11 a.m. Mountain Time in Canada. And all of the CIDR sessions, including this one, are recorded and will be available from the CIDR site. Sorry, and will be available from the CIDR site. I'm going to post the URL for you. I just noticed we've lost our presenter, though, from the room. And so I'm going to pause for a moment and see if he's having. Oh, he's back, thankfully. So, anyways, I will post the link to the CIDR sessions. And as I said, you can pass this along or go back and review the presentation slides or listen to the recording. And yes, Stian, we just noticed you got, we lost you there for a moment, so I'm very relieved to see that you're back in the room. Okay. I'd also like to take a moment to invite those of you who are with us today who have distance education research that you would like to present in a future CIDR session to contact me to discuss that, and I will post my email address in the box for you also. Before we begin today's session, I'd like to quickly go over some of the features in Illuminate for those of you who are new to the platform. As you can see in the window here, I'll just go through the most important part is our audio window. And you can click on the microphone icon in the bottom left-hand corner of the screen in order to speak. And then you have to remember to click on this little icon again when you're done speaking to release it, because we have it set up for just one speaker at a time. You can also adjust your microphone and speaker levels using these sliders to the right of the microphone icon. If you don't have a microphone today, you can use the chat box here to send a message out to the room, or you can send a message to just an individual by hitting the drop-down menu there and then hitting send. In the participant window, we have some emoticons you can use during the session. As I've said before, we just want to see the positive ones in here, the happy faces and the clapping. And if you have any questions during the session, Stian will be stopping periodically for questions and comments. And if somebody's talking and you're waiting and you'd like to know, let us know that you're waiting to use the microphone, you can click on this little hand up icon with the arrow. I see, yeah, go ahead and try it right now, and it just lets us know that you're waiting with a very important comment. And that's about it for the features that you'll be using in today's session. If you have any problems or questions during the presentation, just text a little note to me and I'll help you out. And just for fun here, we are going to see where everybody's coming from today. And I'd like everybody to click on the little wand to the left of Alaska on the map, and then click on the map to let us know where you're at today. And it just, oh, sorry, it should have dropped a, I put the little hand by accident. It should drop a little mine to show us where you're at. I see we've got someone joining us from China. Fantastic. I think that's a first for CIDR. And I'm going to just stop that hands up thing from going on. Great. We've got a very international crew here today, I think. Now I'd like to introduce our presenter for today's session, Stian Hochlev. Stian is a doctoral student in the Department of Curriculum, Teaching and Learning at the Ontario Institute for Studies and Education, as and most of us know that as OISE, at the University of Toronto. He grew up in Norway and has traveled the world working and studying in Italy, Sweden, China, Indonesia, and Mexico. Ian's undergraduate degree was in International Development Studies at the University of Toronto in Scarborough. During that time, he spent a year working for CARE International in Indonesia, and his honors thesis was about the community library movement in Indonesia. Stian completed his MA in the higher education program at OAC, and his thesis focused on the Chinese National Top Level Courses Project. In September of 2010, he began his PhD, which focuses on how to enable collaborative peer-based learning around open educational resources. Today, Stian will be presenting us with a bit of a mashup of information from both of these studies, and I'm grateful for that because I know curriculum development and open educational resources have been hot topics at some of our past CIDR sessions, and of course during the OER week that Athabasca University hosted not long ago. So thank you, Stian, for covering these very important topics and giving up your time for us today. I'll hand over the mic now and let you get started.
Thank you very much, and thank you for all of you who took your time to come here. I'm really excited to be sharing with you some of this is mostly research for my master's thesis, and my master's thesis is available for download. There will be a Chinese version out very soon as well, and so I'll have that link later in the presentation. If you Google my name, you'll find it quite easily. So I'd also love for you to chime in during the presentation on the chat. I might not catch everything, but Lynn will help me, and especially what kind of aspects you're interested in. This master's thesis was in comparative education, and it takes more of a historical policy perspective on these courses. So my master's thesis mainly focuses on how it is that this project came to exist in China at the time that it did, looking at the history of higher education in China for the last 60 years, and actually going back all the way to the Middle Ages and looking at different models of universities and so on. So if that's interesting to you, then I can certainly talk quite a bit about that. But currently I'm in the curriculum teaching and learning, and I'm looking more at the practicalities, both in terms of technology, in terms of open licensing, and in terms of pedagogy. And so that's another aspect that I could address. So I'm just going to get started, and feel free to chime in, and also there will be some time during the presentation for questions and so on. So the Chinese top-level courses, it was a real journey for me. I guess a lot of people say that, but I think it's fun when you start a research project and you really have no clue where you're going to end up. At the time I began looking into this, actually, I was taking an online course with David Wiley back in 2007, and he had us read some evaluation reports. Brian, top-level courses definition coming up very soon. So I was reading an evaluation report from MIT OpenCourseWare, which you probably have heard of, and they were saying how China was not only translating Chinese courses, MIT courses into Chinese, but they were also producing their own OpenCourseWare. And so I got really interested in the concept that they had kind of borrowed this idea from America, and how appropriate it was for Chinese culture, and also how it might have changed when it arrived in China. And so that's how I started out looking into this. But of course, after a long time, I realized that the story was a very different one. So anyway, I'll get started, and here's my brief outline. I'll start kind of in media res. What is Chinese top-level courses? Hopefully answering Brian's question. And how does it work? So I'll basically describe this project, because it's very poorly understood outside of China, and it's a huge and very important project. It's useful to know about. It's also very different from any other project that you might have heard of. I'll take a little break there, and I'll talk a little bit about how did it come to be, what's the context for this, why is Chinese higher education quite different from Western education, and I'll take another little break, and then I'll talk a little bit about both the future of this project as well as distance education in China, which I'm not an expert on at all, but I have spent quite a bit of time there, and I know a lot of people in the field, so I might be able to give you at least a few thoughts on that. So for my own research, I started out by participating in a research conference in Dalian in 2008. I've participated in a number of international conferences around open courseware to give me the comparative perspective, you know, from the Western side. Read a bunch of Chinese academic journal articles and policies, spent about 7 months in total in China, and did both formal interviews as well as a large array of informal visits with professors and research students. And as you can see from this, I see the red ring was actually supposed to be a little bit further to the right, but this is a search for the keyword of the China top-level courses in Chinese, and it gives you more than 3,000 peer-reviewed articles on this specific topic. And it's a topic that has almost no publications at all in English. So, you know, that's an interesting fact in itself. And it's also quite daunting for a researcher who speaks Chinese but is certainly not, you know, at a native level to come in and be faced with this kind of amount of material. And that's why it was so important for me to have really good connections with Chinese academics and have them kind of recommend the resource that would be most useful to me. So basically, what is the Top Level Courses Project? Well, it was started in 2003, and the idea is to choose the best courses in China through competition. So, and these are, you know, initially they were face-to-face classes, so traditional classroom classes. Then they added vocational classes and online courses as well. But they were competing in how well they did what they were supposed to do. So a traditional classroom-based course would compete in how well did it teach the students in the class, not in how good were the online resources. That's important to remember. And the reason why the government decided to invest a lot of money into such a competition was several things, and I'll touch more on it in the next section, but maybe the two most important ones were the massification of higher education in China. So there was an incredible growth in the number of undergraduate students and also faculty. So there was a real need to maintain the quality of education. At the same time as massification happened, there was this push for world-class universities. And, you know, some of the top universities in China, like Beijing University, Tsinghua University, were getting large amounts of money building key laboratories and attracting foreign faculty, and, you know, turned into exactly what we know in the West, where it's publish or perish. And the top professors would spend all their time publishing, right? And so they said, well, we want the top professors also to spend their time thinking about teaching, and we have to make it worth their while. And right now, you know, whether you teach well or not well doesn't make much difference to your life. And so we want to really reward those who go above and beyond in teaching. And then the second part of that is that we want to take those courses that we have already selected as being excellent, and we want to use those to inspire others. So people would apply for this, and there were three levels of awards. So there's the campus level, the university level, the provincial level, and the national level. And these are, you know, progressively more difficult. So you had to go one by one. You couldn't apply directly to the national project. And so basically, if you were a professor who thought you had a course that could stand up, or perhaps your dean, which often was the case, would say that, you know, we would like to have someone apply for this, would you like to try? You would have to document carefully the whole design of your class, and this is what you do on these online websites. So you create a website, you upload most of your teaching material, but again, this isn't designed, if it's a face-to-face class, it's not necessarily designed for online teaching. That's not the goal. They're using the online medium to peer review face-to-face teaching. But of course, in the case of the courses that were taught online from the beginning, they'll use very different evaluation criteria when looking at that material. So you publish this on the website, you do some lecture recordings, you have teaching reflections, you know, portfolio, you have your PowerPoints, you have exam questions, you might even have student evaluations from past years. And this is reviewed by a group of experts from other universities, according to very specific criteria set up by the ministry. And if you win, then you get honor. Your department gets honor. Your university can boast of how many great courses they have. And you get a certain amount of money, which is not small in China. For the national courses, it's about probably around $12,000-$13,000, which is quite a lot of money considering academic salaries in China. And you are asked to make that course available online for 5 years. So again, you're not making it available because they think that this is going to be a brilliant resource to teach thousands of students. You're making it available because it's an excellent class that can inspire other teachers. Now, of course, students might visit it, just like happened at MIT, where also the initial purpose was to inspire other teachers, but that's not the main goal necessarily. It's also interesting that one of the criteria of applying is that you cannot be the sole. So, Chris, I know what you mean by open course. They don't use open licenses, and to much of my chagrin, I've tried to tell anyone who wants to listen that that would be a good idea. But it's open licenses aren't very well known in China. And there's also not very many social features. So it's, again, not designed to be a great place for students to go, although obviously some people go and consult them. It's more to inspire other teachers. So it's not a traditional distance setting at all. Even for those online courses that were online from the very beginning, of course, they would have probably much more complete and better designed materials, but you wouldn't get the benefit of all the interaction that you would if you were actually paying money for that course. So, and what's interesting too, if you compare this this project with many of these open courses in the West, is that they never ever used the words expanding access in any of their material. That was never mentioned as a goal. The goal was purely to improve the quality of teaching. So again, a very different approach, right? So what I was just saying is, you can't apply as a single professor. You have to have a teaching team, and that teaching team should consist of a young professor, some young professors, maybe just out of graduate school, excited about technology, some middle-aged professors, and some really senior professors. And these will often be people, emeritus who wrote the first textbook in the subject, or people who are very well known. And so, part of the idea was not just to have these groups of faculty come together and actually then, reflect upon this course. Because if you're teaching a course by yourself in a traditional face-to-face university, it's very lonely. You don't have many people to talk to about your course. And so by bringing these groups together, you would have this transfer of knowledge among generations, which is seen as important. And it actually is something that has a much longer history in China than in the West to have these teaching teams. So as I mentioned, part of the purpose was to induce these full professors, these very prestigious research professors, to teach undergraduate courses and to really put their mind to teaching the best that they could. It was to encourage professors to use more technology in their teaching. So this started, more than almost 10 years ago. And it was the continuation of some large investment projects too that were aiming at, bringing in the more use of learning management systems and all these kind of things. And part of the idea was that since they have to use a website if they want to apply to this project, hopefully they'll learn through that experience and then later be much more likely to use technology with their own students as well. It encouraged this formation of teaching teams that I thought about, that I mentioned, and also this key aspect that very much unlike, for example, MIT, where they say, you know, MIT is the best in the world, and we would just want to be charitable and share of our excellence with others. You know, we would never ask an MIT professor if his course is worthy or not. He's an MIT professor, so of course it is. In China, you know, they don't want what you have right now. They want you to really create this teaching team and then completely rethink your course, do some research, both in terms of having the most up-to-date subject material, but also course material. Brian, as far as I know, in the face-to-face universities, they don't really have people who are designated as instructional designers. They have people working more on the website, so they have people who do, you know, film and media, and some of those might have a little bit of training, but not in the way that you're thinking about it. Whereas in the online universities, the production model is much more similar to what we know from open universities, where you have these groups of people with very specific job descriptions. Here's one interesting case study I came across in the literature. This is Lanzhou City University. And what's also interesting is that they had, you know, these competitions, which are very foreign to us in at least you know, traditional research universities. You don't really tend to, you know, have a competition of what's the best course at the University of Toronto. It would be kind of absurd. You can have the most appreciated teacher, but everyone knows that's very subjective. And to have the concept of some peer review committee who's going to go and choose the best course kind of, to us, seems to fly in the face of educational freedom and so on. But this was something that actually was established in China since 1985. And so many of the courses that first applied to get this top-level courses award in 2003 were courses that had already gone through several rounds of these internal competitions and had been built up sometimes over decades with, you know, because it's also very common that PhD students, when they graduate, they stay at the same university. So some of these courses would have been started by someone's doctoral supervisor who was now retired, and that tradition was carried on by their advisee who is now a professor themselves. Though what's interesting here too is that they chose courses that could have an impact on the whole department. So they would kind of choose the you know, basic courses maybe that a lot of professors were involved in, and try to use this as a way of creating kind of excitement around the idea of discussing pedagogy, improving your courses, looking into new ways of teaching and learning, and so on. And this honor thing, it's really, I mean, true, I've seen it myself, that people are really proud of getting these. They know it's very hard, especially the national ones, and universities will definitely brag about it on their website, and they'll say, you should come to us because we have, you know, this many courses that's been selected to be top-level courses, and it shows that we take teaching and learning really seriously. And I mean, that's kind of a refreshing thing to hear after, you know, you're so used to all these rankings in the West that only ever care about the research publications and really have no way at all of measuring teaching and learning. So that's definitely an important aspect. And initially in 2003, this project was launched by itself, but it was actually the forerunner of a larger project, which was called the Quality Project, which has a huge amount of different parts to it, as you see there. And so from 2007, when it was renewed in its second phase, it became part of this Quality Project. And there's a lot of, I haven't looked into any of these, but I know that there's a lot of other initiatives aimed at raising the quality of education in China. So that's where it kind of fits in. Now, for the actual infrastructure, from 2003 to 2007, universities published the courses by themselves, and created this website by themselves, and all the ministry would do is to link to all the universities that were participating. And you'd have to go to, let's say, University of Toronto, and University of Toronto would list all the open courses that they had. But of course, it was very hard. And this is basically how it works with open courseware. For example, today you go to Yale and you look at Yale's open courses. You go to Harvard and you look at Harvard's open courses. But that's and there are some portals. And so in 2007, as they launched the second cycle, they said, we need to do something to make this this material much more easy to find for the students and for teachers. So they launched this top-level courses portal, which is under the Higher Education Press in China, which is part of the Ministry of Education. And it's actually a really nice portal, beautifully designed, very functional, very Web 2.0. And I took a bunch of screenshots because I thought, this is something that most of you won't be able to kind of explore by yourself. And so I thought it'd be fun to just show you a little bit about how they've actually designed this. So this is the website as you see it when you just come there. They have a bunch of news about the project. They have links to courses and resources. So if we go to the course section, let's see if I click on this one. Let's see, can you see my, can you see my moving thing now? Yeah. So in this section, you see a list of the different disciplines. And here you see some of the featured courses. And if you, for example, this is literature, so they have, humanities, so they have about 1,600 courses in literature and humanities. And the first one here is Chinese literature and culture. So 474 courses just in that small topic. I mean, in total, they've produced more than 12,000 courses over the time that this project has been in existence. So, from 700 different universities. So it's really a massive project. I mean, it's quite hard for us to even fathom. Now, if we go here, and what I thought I would do is to, because we are interested in distance education, and of course, in China, the biggest player in distance education is Open University of China. And so I did a search here for courses designed by Open University of China. So I thought that might be interesting to you. And I found a few hundred courses. So I selected one course that's produced by the Open University of China and that's been selected to be a national level top course. And this is this is high level accounting. Now, we're still at that portal page, and this is the individual course page for that course. And what's interesting is that instead of just pointing to that course, this portal has actually kind of sucked in a lot of the content from the website. So you see the screenshot here. There's a link to the actual school website. But here in the menu, you see all the different elements of the course that has been kind of sucked into this portal. So oftentimes you don't even need to go to this external website. So if we click here, for example, this is the, no, it's very small writing. I think this is the teaching plans. So they huge amounts of different documents that they upload, teaching plans, lesson plans probably, slides that they show the students, mock exams, and you can even read these documents directly on the site. So it's all very nice and integrated, a huge amount of materials. And if we now go to the actual website, you'll see, because this is designed for distance education, it's obviously much more complete than some of the other courses where which are designed for delivery through the classroom. So, despite the fact that you don't get any tutorial help here, but it's really a very complete course. And just to show you that, it's actually funny, they have, so this is all canned, as you call it, Chris. In the actual courses which they teach for people who pay for it, I'm sure they have chat sessions. They might have, actually some of these distance courses, they do tend to have meetups once a week, often in the weekend as well. But this is just a dead resource. There's no social aspect to it. This is a questionnaire for students where they're asking if the students found it useful. And here's another questionnaire for teachers where they're saying, was this inspiring to you? Did you change your teaching practices because of it? Alicia, they don't really do that. I mean, there's not much incentive for them to do so. And I've always argued that, you know, that should be our task, because they are so active in taking the best of MIT OpenCourseWare and so on and translating that to Chinese. And MIT always goes around bragging about how they're being translated to all these languages around the world. And I would love for us to do the same and go to China and find the best courses and actually translate them back to English. But I don't see any Western universities kind of interested in that. Anyway, and here's one case study where they have, it's a detailed case study about accounting. A lot of written material, and then they have the actual questions, and here's the solution. So you could work through it yourself. Again, all dead resources, but you know, a huge amount of material that's available to anyone who wants to. And so I kind of raced through that, but I want to just give you a sense of how this project kind of works practically. And I think I'll stop there a little bit. Maybe we can take some questions before I tell you a little bit more about where this comes from historically, even though I've mentioned a few things already.
Hi, Stian. I'm going to actually jump in first because there was a couple of good questions that came up in the chat. And I'm just trying to scroll back. I think it was Martha had a question about, she wanted to know what the criteria was for choosing the top level courses. And I think that came up earlier too. Could you explain that, please?
Yeah, so in my thesis, I actually have the whole list. I think there's about 15 different criteria, and they actually change the weighting slightly every year. So it's interesting to kind of see how they're gradually emphasizing, you know, different things. But it goes on everything from the design of the material to the pedagogy to the use of interactive resources and stuff. And again, it's important to remember that they're basically using, I mean, more so in the case of traditional classroom-based education, they're basically using the online resources as a proxy to evaluate what happens in the classroom. They're not looking to evaluate the online resource as a standalone resource by itself. They're not looking at how useful is this to students. Now, in the case of the distance education course, of course, that will be different because they were designed to be taught online from the very beginning.
Thanks, Stian. Chris had a question. I'll just hand the microphone over to him or her. Sorry, I don't know.
It's her. Thank you. Yeah, I just want to wrap my head around what a typical top-level online course, how it works. How does this course work? Thanks.
So again, you know, these are dead resources, and the purpose of this project is not to create a huge database of educational resources so students who can't, let's say, get into university can go and use these resources instead. It's very different from what they're trying to do in America, right? And it's important to keep that in mind. So basically what they do is they try to find courses that are really good as they happen face-to-face or in an online setting as they happen with paid tutors and meetups and all that stuff. And once they do that, you know, they have those teachers really document very well what they do, the educational practices that they undertake, and they share that with other teachers. I mean, that's the main thrust of this. And of course, you know, because there's so much material there, a lot of students will be interested too, but that's not really how they would evaluate the success of this project. Now, since my study was more policy and historical based, I haven't done a deep dive into kind of the actual pedagogies of these courses. I mean, I've looked at a bunch of them, but I haven't done any rigorous study of it.
Thanks. I see Sophia has her hand up and wants the mic, so I'll release that for you, Sophia. Sorry, Sophia, we didn't hear you. Do you want to try again? Just text your question or comment then, Sophia, and while you're doing that, there was a few other people who had questions and comments. I think Brian said he, sorry, What influences have you seen in students, teachers, and course materials related to culture, was the question.
Well, that is a broad one, and I don't know if you're talking about Chinese students or American students or Chinese students in Canada, or I mean, it's a big one. I will talk a little bit about how Chinese academia is different from Western academia, though, in this next session. And for John Goldsmith, I mean, they have 100% influence because this is a project that's 100% funded by the Ministry of Education, so they're running the show. I mean, obviously, they're using, you know, they're working closely with all the universities. They have, you know, it's peer reviewed by academics and so on. But you know, there's no pretending that this is an independent, that this is somehow independent of the government at all. And to Sophia, no, they don't. They have three categories of courses. One is traditional academic undergraduate courses. That was the first one. Then they have vocational courses, which is more kind of community colleges, and they have online courses, and the criteria are quite different. For example, you know, vocational courses would put a lot more emphasis on the practical aspects and maybe have even internships and stuff like that. And online courses, they would look at much more complete material that's really designed for online use, which the other material won't be. And they'll also look at interactivity and you know, the social design of the class and so on. And Marta, if you go to the CIDR, I mean, I can type it in right here, but if you go to the CIDR talks, there's a link to my thesis just underneath the link or above the link to this presentation.
I think maybe we should move on at this point, Stan. I'm not sure if there are some questions missed here. I'm just conscious of time. So if you did have a comment or question that was missed, perhaps you could bring that back up at the end of the session, okay?
Thank you. So very quickly, Chris, yes, there are big internet filters, and you know, but actually, almost every single Western tool has a clone in China, so even though you can't use YouTube, you can use Youku, and even though you can't use Facebook, you can use Xiaonai, and they often actually have better functionality than the Western tools by now. Certainly, their Twitter clone is much more fancy than our Twitter, and most Chinese are actually quite uninterested in, you know, both mainly because of language in using those Western tools, but of course, it's a huge problem. And John, I don't think online courses have the same status as F2F courses there either, sadly. You know, that's always a problem. And it's also an interesting thing whether, you know, you'd rather go to the Open University, which has specialized in distance education but maybe isn't as famous, or do you want to go to do an online course at one of the traditional universities that might not know much about teaching online at all, but they have that very well-recognized name. Anyway, I'm going to get back to my presentation for a little bit. And so, you know, basically, hopefully from what I've been saying, this sounds like quite different from what you would find in North America, specifically in traditional universities. In fact, it's a lot closer to what you might find in a distance or an open university, which has been quite fascinating to me throughout this whole time. And so I went back in history and tried to find out, you know, why is it that the situation in China is so different? And of course, there's a lot of different reasons for that. But basically, you know, looking at the heritage of universities, basically all universities in the world hark back to either the French or the German model of the medieval university. And these were quite different. The German one is kind of the predecessor to the traditional North American research university. You know, that's where we had the Humboldt University, and we had academic freedom, that concept, for the first time. And even in a state that wasn't democratic, just like China isn't democratic today, they still recognized that giving a certain amount of freedom to academics would actually be beneficial to society. And this wasn't just political freedom, but also substantial freedom to organize their own research and teaching. And there's also a little bit this concept of the charismatic academic, where, you know, especially for graduate school, basically your concept of education was to have these amazing personalities and just let students spend time with them as apprentices, and they would soak up this, you know, knowledge and skills and understanding. And, you know, professors were encouraged to teach what they were interested in, and there was a very close link between research and teaching. Now, I'm simplifying horribly here, but just trying to give you kind of a quick overview. The French model at the same time was very different. It was extremely centralistic. And one of the French ministers of education used to boast that, you know, 9 o'clock on Monday morning, he knew which page every single first grader in all of France was on. So it was extremely, you know, centralized. All the professors were actually civil servants, so they were directly working for the state, and the state much used higher education much more as a planning tool. And they separated, you know, teaching from research quite strongly. So most of the research ended up happening in research institutes, and universities were mainly for teaching. And professors were evaluated on how well they taught things that had been planned out. So people actually sat down and said, well, if you're going to get a degree in this, what kind of courses do you need to take? So there are obviously, you know, good and bad things about both of these aspects. But what is the case is that the French model was imported into Russia, and actually before the Soviet Union, but during the Soviet Union, it fits very well with, you know, the idea that academia is there to serve the state. And Russia also went along to split up these huge comprehensive universities into tiny, very specialized units because they were afraid of this, you know, the politics of these big universities that felt that they had some autonomy and that they had some space where there could be independent thinking. So instead of having a big Moscow university, you would have the University of Mining and the University of Laying Roads. And these universities would not be funded through the Ministry of Education, but directly through the different ministries. So the Ministry of Mining would fund the University of Mining, and then it would give jobs to all the graduates. Right? It's a very different situation. And basically when China became independent in 1949, they wholesale took over the Russian, the Soviet education system. They had thousands of experts coming over to train them. They translated thousands of textbooks from Russian to Chinese, and, you know, they introduced this incredibly centralistic and controlled system where everything that was going to be taught was decided centrally. And this, you know, went on until about 1985, when there was liberal, both economic and political liberalization. That's when, Deng Xiaoping announced that China was going to open to the world. And that's when universities began to get a little bit more freedom, not full freedom by far, but a little bit of freedom to determine their own courses or ways of teaching them. And what's interesting is that exactly that year is the same year that the first course evaluation systems started coming out, and people started experimenting with evaluating courses. And that has, you know, since 1985 has been growing into something, you know, very well developed. So all universities had all these competitions for courses and criteria for courses, and they would be reviewed, and people would come and listen in on your class and so on. And you could see that from two sides. You could see it as paternalistic and controlling and negative, or you could see it as, you know, a very positive kind of concern for pedagogy and teaching and learning. And I'm sure that the truth is a bit of both. But, you know, so the idea of teaching teams is also something that goes back back to the Soviet model. And actually, the idea that these professors would not only teach the course, but they would do research on their teaching. So part of their scholarship for any discipline would be to research their own teaching and experiment and document and so on, which, and I must say, I find that quite a wonderful idea. And so you had this tradition of teaching evaluations and courses and so on. Then you had this other tradition of excellent, basically, you know, China as a culture really admires these ideals. So they will choose, you know, ideal people sometimes, ideal projects, and they will hold them up for everyone else to be inspired. They had some huge investment projects in higher education that started in the 1990s, where they would elect, you know, select the best top X number of universities through a system of peer review, and they would give them a large amount of extra funding for them to become really excellent and internationally well known. After that project, they said, okay, now we're going to choose the best disciplines, because even though your university comprehensively might not be the best in China, perhaps you have one discipline or one faculty that's really outstanding. So we're going to identify the best faculties, and we're going to provide extra money and training and, you know, grow this excellence. And so in a sense, it was only natural then in 2003 to say, well, now we're going to find the best courses in China, and we're going to provide them with extra money and resources to be even better and to inspire all the other people to improve their own teaching. So that's basically, you know, and what's interesting, I started this presentation by saying how MIT kind of portrayed this as coming straight out of MIT and that the Chinese were so impressed by what MIT was doing. Now, I can't prove or disprove whether there was any effect at all of the MIT project in China. And then certainly, I'm sure in, you know, later year, I mean, everyone knows about it in China. And it's quite possible that it has had some effect on their thinking, but I can almost certainly say that it wasn't the reason this project was started, because they started at about the same time. And as I was showing you, this project comes from, it's very, very differently organized than the MIT, for example, OpenCourseWare, has very different purposes and so on, and it comes from a completely different historical and academic context. So that was a brief kind of spin through history. I'm going to take a little break again, and then I'll talk a little bit about the current situation and some future trends.
Please feel free to grab the microphone icon if you have a question or comment.
It doesn't look like it, so I'll just keep going, and we can do it all at the end. So when it comes to top-level courses themselves, they're actually a little bit in flux right now. There was initial funding from 2003 to 2007, and at that time it was renewed, and it became part of the quality project, which I mentioned to you, until 2011. And obviously we're now in 2011, and they've also changed the Minister of Education, who was there during almost a whole period of the project. Now, most people I've talked to expect it to continue in some form or shape, but it is possible that it will be quite changed. Maybe the new minister wants to put his mark on it, or maybe the situation is changing. So, you know, that probably we'll find out in a few months, or maybe even sooner, but right now we don't really know. As for the broader perspective on China, they came out last year with this education plan 2010-2020, and it was very interesting to see what kind of numbers they were planning for. Of course, you know, the government knows that they're going to be in power for the next 10 years, so it's not like in Canada where they can, you know, where they might be out of power after 2 years and not get much done. And it's also coming on the heels of an incredibly impressive decade. I came to China first time in 2001. I taught English there, and at that time there were 4 million undergrads in all of China. Today there are more than 30 million undergrads in all of China. So, you know, eight, nine times more in 9 years, 10 years. An incredible massification. With just huge new campuses being built, an insane amount of money being invested into higher education. So, you know, they've gone from 5% of the cohort, and I'll show you the numbers here. So in 2009, we had 30 million students, of which you see here 28 million on campus, which I guess means 2 million are doing distance education. So I think there's also people doing distance education who are not degree students, so they wouldn't be counted in this number. Now, that is an increase in 2001, there were 5% of the eligible cohort of 18-year-olds or whatever who went to university. Today, it's 25%, so five times larger percentage. And in 2020, this is really interesting. They're going to increase the enrollment only with 5 million. So, I mean, not a large percentage over 10 years. But they will go from 25% to 40% participation rate. And the reason for that is because they will have smaller cohorts. And, of course, they know that because those cohorts have already been born. They're 9 years old or whatever right now. So, you know, this is a result of the one-child policy and so on. So for you know, I can't even imagine what kind of a different society China will be when you go in 20 years from 5% of your population getting access to higher education to 40%. And Martha, I mean, nobody you know pretends that China's education system is as good as Canada's or America's, right? But if you compare India and China, India today is still at 5% of the population going to university, and China is at 25%. So, and it's really making huge strides, and I think it's incredibly impressive. Now, what's interesting about this thing, though, is that China, you know, they're kind of happy with the amount of people going to university. They're not going to radically increase that, but they are going to radically increase another number. And if you go down here and you see employed persons in continuing education, right now that's 166 million people, and they want to more than double that to 350 million people. Employed persons in continuing education. So more people than there are in the US. And I don't know much details about this, but it's clearly something that they are putting a lot of effort into. I see a lot of research projects now coming up, a lot of funding. And one direct result of this is more emphasis on this Open University of China. You know, traditionally, the Open University, which used to be called the TV and Radio University, was kind of a stopgap because there were huge numbers of people who wanted to go to university and were not able to. Traditionally, it would be very difficult for people to get admission to any university. Today, almost everyone who wants to go to university are able to do so if they can afford it. However, you know, there's a huge difference in the levels of universities. And so there's very, very, very fierce competition for people to go to the top universities. But there isn't as much need anymore for this online university to be kind of the stopgap for those who cannot get in at all. Those people who are coming straight out of high school, they would rather go to a physical face-to-face university. And so what it seems to be is that the government is pushing the Open University into do more lifelong learning, do more job training, and you know, non-traditional populations. And as part of that, and this is a project, it's still kind of secretive, I don't know very much about it, but they are, traditionally the Open University of China was this one, could be thought of as the biggest university system in the world with 2.7 million students, but they had a central office in Beijing and then they had these provincial offices that used the educational materials developed centrally, but they were quasi-autonomous, and they were teaching these courses in their provinces. And what's happening now is that certain provinces are breaking out, and they are establishing themselves as independent open universities, and with a new vision to really provide lifelong learning that is much more flexible than has been the case, because the Open University was in China was never as flexible as the Open University in the UK. It was still focused on degree education. You needed to have a high school certificate, and you needed to take courses leading up to some kind of a degree or diploma. And this new project that they're starting will be much more flexible in terms of accepting people without high school degrees, letting you study for as long as you want, not necessarily 1 year, 2 years, or 3 years, and apparently also quite interested in using some of these open educational resources in their teaching. In fact, the Beijing Open University has hired Sir John Daniels from the Commonwealth of Learning as one of their main consultants. And so, you know, it's certainly an effort that they're putting a lot of money into, and I still don't quite know what it will turn into, but it's sure to be something quite fascinating. And John, I wouldn't be surprised if there were. I'm certainly in a few years thinking about applying for a job in China. Now, the last thing I want to mention, because I know we're headed towards the end here, but it's quite interesting, really. I mentioned that I came across this in the beginning because MIT OpenCourseWare were bragging about how they had a huge impact on Chinese education. And there was an NGO in China called CORE, which translated a number of Chinese MIT courses into Chinese. But they never had very much reach. I mean, there was a website, some students had a look at it, but you know, it was not something that I would say had a huge impact at all. But over the last probably 1.5 years, it's changed completely. And I think part of it is because you have these subtitling groups who are used to, you know, volunteers who subtitle Frasier and Friends and Simpsons. You know, they download it on BitTorrent and they'll subtitle it to Chinese just for fun, so that their friends can watch these shows. And they've begun subtitling the videos coming out, because that's the one thing that these projects never did. They translated the PowerPoints and stuff, but people didn't want to see that. They, you know, and I think part of the reason is this lure of, you know, the most famous universities in the world, right? Being able to kind of peek through the doors is much more exciting than you could just buy a book, right? And so you have all these subtitles, and then some of these big video portals in China, like NetEase and Youku, basically the Vimeo and YouTube of China, started making these elaborate course portals. So here you see NetEase. It's the biggest internet company in China. They have this huge OpenCourseWare portal, which looks way better than MIT's own pages, right? And they have videos. It's all subtitled in Chinese. And they have just millions and millions of views. And this has become the newest craze in China. Basically, it's the TED Talk. You know, it's the kind of thing that white-collar workers are standing around the water cooler saying, did you see that course with that guy? And this is the most popular course in China right now, The Philosophy of Death from Yale. Somehow, you know, if you're working in a white-collar position in China and you haven't seen this show, you won't be welcome at their cocktail party. It's quite insane. And there's been a lot of media in China, a lot of newspapers writing about this. This is a kind of a Facebook of China. So there's a lot of people starting these study groups where they will watch these videos together, and they'll ask each other questions, and they'll kind of study together. This is another site started by some Beijing University students who also show these foreign courseware projects, but add these collaborative study features and so on. So I think that's a very interesting trend. And you know, it's kind of too bad that they're only so fascinated by all the international stuff and they don't really do the same things for the Chinese material, because I think some of it is quite good. I mean, in 12,000 courses, there must be some gems, but there is something about always looking outside for something that's more prestigious. The one good news, though, is that the first Chinese universities actually began releasing some open courses to this same project. And to my knowledge, that's the first time a Chinese university has taken their own initiative to release open resources rather than waiting for the central state to say, here's this competition, here's this money. They're actually taking their own initiative. And I think that's also something that's going to be really exciting to follow. So I think I'll say thank you there, and we'll see if we have time for a few questions. And you see the address to my thesis there as well as my email.
I'm going to just jump in really quickly, Stan, and say thank you so much for sharing this very interesting presentation with us today. It's definitely new to our participants, getting a view of what's going on in China. So thank you for this fresh perspective. And I'll open up the floor for questions and comments quickly.
Just